Yeah.
Oh, it does that
crazy thing.
Crazy, scary, very strong American voice telling you it's recording, which is kind of creepy, I think. It sounds very real. It's like the more robotic version of Siri. To me, anyway, or Alexa, or whatever. Wait, shit.
It sounds like when you buy something off Alibaba and they say Bluetooth connecting.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. So we're doing another podcast. There's a lot of people sitting around the virtual table here in literally all different parts of the UK. And we're going to talk about the fuckening. What I've been calling
that's what you're referring to it as, is it?
Well, it's not what I'm referring it to it as, but that's what I've referred it to as personally.
Is that the name of your YouTube video?
Yes. It's on my OnlyFans as well, Jimmy.
I see. Okay. I haven't had a notification yet, though.
Oh, sorry, mate. You make sure they're turned on. Are they definitely turned on?
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
So we've got Jimmy and Emily from Atticus, Andy from Andyville, and Jack from Jackland, which is basically the combination of everyone that was kind of there throughout the Severn Everest project from start to finish. Emily being there virtually, but actually was disguised as Jimmy 2.0, Jimmy's second phone, because Jimmy's got a gangster phone and a Jimmy phone. And so
it could not work.
So I wanted to basically do this podcast, like getting everyone together and sort of reflect a bit on what happened. How long ago was it now? Some while ago. I can't think how long ago. It feels like it was nearly a month ago now, I think. Coming up for a month, believe it or not.
Really?
Well,
I don't think that's true.
Well, no, it is. Because it's the 9th of June now, and I started on what? The 16th? Well, 3 weeks.
Kind of close.
3 weeks. Which is pretty crazy to think about, it, actually. And considering, I don't know about you guys, but I've just spent 3 weeks basically doing fuck all, to be perfectly honest.
That's good for you.
Yeah, it'd be great. Lots of sleep. Well, actually, not enough sleep. Lots of sitting. I'm getting really good at sitting. I might do a new Instagram account called Crystal Sits.
Which basically is your Instagram account now, isn't it? But you're sitting on a bike rather than a chair.
Yeah, exactly.
Crystal sits on different things.
Yeah. Coming soon.
Get a bit weird.
What I was going to do, and I admit I really did last minute sort of ask Emily to help out again, I'm sorry, is kind of let Emily run this podcast and basically talk to the four of us kind of about what happened and our perspective on it, because obviously the film is now live. There's quite a lot of stuff out there. Atticus did a really fantastic like blog following it, and also did an incredible job of keeping the story going during the challenge, because I quite frankly couldn't do that. I was fucked. But it allowed people to see what was going on day by day through the blog and also through Instagram and social media, which thank you for doing that. They were fantastic. Jack basically took over the reins of being the chief photographer / mum, I'm going to say, and really sort of, you know, kept on top of keeping Jimmy alive, which is incredibly important. Andy created the film and was there for good vibes and hypes more than anything, keeping everyone happy and smiling, because Andy's an incredibly positive person, which was incredibly useful during the whole challenge, I think, for everyone. But also randomly would do stuff. I'm trying to think of a really good example now.
I feel like I used up all my positivity for 5 years.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of us might be like that. But I mean, you do definitely take the award for the most farts over the course of a week. I'm going to say that one. I don't care how embarrassing that is for you, but there was a lot of them.
The first thing that springs to my mind was the nipple and the clamp situation that was going on as well.
Everybody's face sounds like, what?
Positivity and good vibes, right?
I forgot about that. I
should take the reins at this point, because as an outsider, maybe everyone listening to you, we're all going, what? Maybe we should add some context to the story. Yes.
Okay. I don't even remember what actually happened. I just remember I had somehow had nipples. Not nipples on my clamps. Clamps on my nipples at some point. I don't know why.
Oh, sorry, Emily.
It's interesting, though, because I guess, like, you know, we were live vlogging the challenge and you got to see it from your perspective. But I think there's sort of the behind the scenes and what goes into the sort of support side of something like this, you kind of don't really get to see unless you're there. So it'll be interesting to, I think maybe what we should do is kind of start at the beginning, go through day by day, but kind of hear from everyone about, you know, what their perspective of it was and what jobs they were doing to help Chris and that kind of thing. So yeah. Why don't you kick us off, Chris, with day one, which is probably what you most remember. I'm sure after that it becomes a bit of a blur.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I would say probably past about sort of day three, everything is a bit blurry and what actually happened on what day. But the first day for me, the main thing I remember first of all is waking up and feeling like I hadn't had enough sleep, which is pretty standard for anything like this. I always sleep really badly. And then the next thing I remember is looking outside the window and thinking the weather's shit. And that kind of was the course of the rest of the week. It was an early start. It was Jack, Andy and myself in the morning. And Andy was very determined to get a shot of the bedroom light coming on. That's my biggest memory of that day, pretty much, is how determined Andy was to get this shot of this light coming on.
This is all plans always get thrown out when you're tired. We said that every single day and then stopped up in a second because we couldn't be asked anymore.
And it was like, that first day was just kind of for me personally, was like a, how the fuck is this going to go? I don't know. But I'm going to see what happens and just literally try the best I could. But I think in my head the whole time throughout the challenge, especially the first day, there was a lot of like thinking of actually, was it doable? And if so, how doable and how much of it was going to be a negative effect on me, both physically and emotionally. But I'm also quite good at boxing that into a tiny box. And I think I spent a lot of the time just going, right, I've got this amount of reps to do. Let's just start counting them down. And to be honest, that's how the day went for me, was going, okay, there's 33 to go. Let's just get 11 done and break it, or get 5 done, get 6 done, and keep breaking it like that. And on the first day, we had James Bracey from Tailfin come out. And that was really cool because he's a really nice man. And he brought his dog, Dillis, I think is her name. And she like ran along next to us. And that was also the first day that we met Dion, who, if you've watched the film, is the chap talking about his son. And that, I think for me, was the moment when everything kind of really hit home on the importance of the challenge. And then the next kind of thing that really sticks in my head is when Jimmy turned up, because Jimmy is that ray of light that appears. As you can see, he's already glowing. And doing what Jimmy does better than anyone else that I know, which is looking after me, basically. In every sense of the word of looking after me. And that's dealing with my mood, my safety, my energy, basically telling me what to do and what not to do. And from that point, when Jimmy arrived, I felt instantly way more relieved and less stressed, because I knew that Jimmy had my best interest in mind throughout the week, whatever happened. And that, to be honest, is how the week went for me. And that's how that day went for me, rather, as opposed to anything.
So you mentioned Jimmy and when he turned up. You guys have kind of done challenges like that together, and Jimmy kind of, I know, has taken on the role of kind of being your
cuts man, corner man,
yeah, hype man,
wing man, all of those things, yeah,
every type of man. you kind of, is that a role? I feel like that's a role that you just kind of slip into now, because I think when you first kind of agreed to go down, that's not necessarily that wasn't the forefront of the mind of what you were doing.
Originally, I wasn't even going to be there, was I? It was only when you were up with us a couple of weeks beforehand, and we were like, actually, let's see if we can make it work for me to be there.
So I
wasn't actually going to be at this one, but I don't know, I just felt it was massive and it would be good to be there.
It was definitely
evident that Jimmy knew what he needed to do, because like for the entire morning when me and Andy were there, we were just kind of like, okay, we're going to get these shots, we're going to film this, we're going to do this, and then we were watching him rep after rep, and then we were like, he looks pretty fucked.
I was there to put a camera in your face pretty much, but it came to the point, has he eaten in 5 hours?
we were like, how many gels has he had? Does he need any more? What's he doing again? How many laps is it? We don't know. And when Jimmy appeared, we were like, okay, there's someone who actually knows what the hell needs to be done.
It's interesting you say that, because when I got there, it was very apparent to me that you guys had no idea what to do. But, you know, it's a very unique situation, and I've done so many of these things, specifically with Chris as well, because I'd say Chris is different to a lot of people in this space, and I know how Chris works, and what, you know, I've ridden a bike long enough as well to know what happens when you ride a bike for ages. But I think the biggest issue with day one was when I arrived, which I think was basically 2/3 of the way through. I think he'd done 22 of 33 reps or something, or rather just finished block two. Unfortunately, I think by that point in day one, he was already so far down a hole that we just had to straight away go into damage preservation. He was soaking wet, his feet were like absolutely soaked, which doesn't sound like that big a deal, it's only water, but when your feet are wet for 14 hours, like that has a huge impact on your feet and how they feel and how much power you can push and just the whole feel of riding a bike. So really, really quickly after me being there, I wanted to very drastically change what was happening at that point.
Well, I think one of the first photos I got was of Jimmy actually having to take off Chris's shoes as Chris was leaning against the car, because he just couldn't do anything because he was so cold and tired. So yeah, Jimmy was straight into action as soon as he arrived.
On that point about the sort of the weather, the location generally caused quite a lot of issues on this challenge, really. So maybe, Chris, you can kind of talk us through your rationale, because I remember when you sort of told us, and there was some good rationale behind it, but obviously it did present a lot of challenges as well. So talk us through your kind of what made you choose that climb, and in hindsight, what you think of it, I guess.
So the big fundamental reasoning for choosing that climb was it was a closed road. And my reason for that, there's several reasons for that. And the first one was being, from when I did the trenching challenge, the amount of shit I got from cars throughout that whole challenge, and in the daytime and at night, whether that was boy racers ragging it up and down Box Hill, whether that was people just jeering, shouting shit out the window, whether that was people throwing stuff at me out of their car windows. Like, I had so much of that to deal with during that challenge. And I was adamant that for my sanity over the course of the week, I wanted to remove as many obstacles that I possibly could. And cars is a massive obstacle. Admittedly, on the climb, there's a lot of sheep, but sheep is a better obstacle than a car, in my opinion. I know, and I've always known, that part of Wales, the weather is notoriously unpredictable. I was kind of prepared for that. I was quite happy to put my guards on the bike and kind of deal with it. The fact that it's a closed road, in my mind, initially was a good benefit because the road surface was good. Yes, there are some hairpins on that climb, but generally you've got such a long section of it, which is so straight that you can keep a high speed and descend it quickly, which means your time descending is actually quite quick. I also quite like the fact there was a flat bit in the middle because it gave a bit of a respite, but there were obviously some positives and negatives to there being a flat bit. But there was my main thing was the fact that it was closed. In the UK, there's technically only really two closed roads, which I would have been able to have done this on, which is Stoolan Dam or Great Dunfell. Unfortunately, Great Dunfell is steeper and probably has even more unpredictable weather. And then also, unfortunately, we apparently turned up in the most unpredictable week of weather that that area has had. And that wasn't, and it was, according to locals, abnormally volatile for the time of year. We were told by many people that it was incredibly unseasonable conditions and that they couldn't predict the weather because of how the front was sitting on that part of Wales. So it was literally changing hourly. So my rationale was very much on the safety context more than anything. I knew that doing something for a week, especially of this kind of magnitude, was going to be really, really hard. And you do get quite serious lapses in concentration during that on a daily basis. So safety is always paramount. Yes, I have sponsors, but no, I would never say that I was classed as like a full-time athlete. I still have other things I need to do. I still need to pay bills. And my health is worth more than me than crashing, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of my rationales with it, really.
And in hindsight, if you were to restart this challenge, would you do the same thing again? Would you go somewhere else? Do you even think it's possible in the UK, considering the lack of closed road? And I guess if you even want a quiet road, you have to go high up into hills and you've got unpredictable weather.
I think it is possible in the UK, but you are, so there's quite an interesting part that comes with this conversation. So I spoke to my coach, Ken, several times afterwards. And the first thing I said to him was like, I don't think it's possible. And he turned around to me and said, on the contrary, I think you've proven that it's completely possible because the hours were done that would have required to have done it. Now, to do it in the UK, I think you to actually be able to achieve it, you're going to have to close a road on that aspect of safety. And you need to be so lucky with the weather for the week. So whether it's done in a slightly different time of the year, I do think it's doable in the UK. If I was to do it again, though, to be perfectly honest, I'd go and do it abroad. I'd literally do it abroad.
I said, about 2 days before the start, I was like, let's sack off Wales. Let's go to Tenerife. It's going to cost some money, but screw it. Let's just do it. We can Tenerife, it'd be mint. And then it would have been like, how many reps is it? Reps of Tater is it? Like 4 reps or something?
Like 4. So I do think it's doable, and I it's definitely doable on Tater, for example, I reckon. And I mean, in terms of doing it in the UK, the safety aspect has to come into it massively. And I feel that that's because of the. In the UK, maybe we don't have as much of a culture towards cycling as car drivers. And in a challenge, which is, you know, realistically, you're talking 13 to say 16 hours a day on a bike where you are going to be fatigued and you are going to make mistakes. You have to make things as safe as you possibly can for you. But I'd just do it in Tenerife.
I actually think that the other thing with the UK roads is that the roads that are good enough to be Everest in most cases are like country roads, which perhaps are quite narrow and have 60 mile an hour speed limits.
Yeah.
You know, there's not like, there isn't an appropriate climb in a city that's like got a 20 mile an hour speed limit or something or other, which would probably be better to do it on. Well, yeah. maybe not. But a lot of the roads that are used or you would even consider using are really rural lanes, quite tight, probably used by people out on like a Sunday drive in their like convertible classic car and are not thinking about cyclists going up and down.
Exactly. Well, if you went to Europe and did something like this, you're going to get a wide road, great vision around it, and incredible tarmac as well.
Probably loads of other cyclists on the road, tons of them.
Yeah.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it day one where the decision was made to bring Chris on the turbo?
Yes. So when I got there, I actually wanted to change his shoes, but you didn't want to change your shoes because you're very particular about the shoes that you've got and you didn't want to change them, which was fine. Mm-hmm. But I think we pretty much went straight onto the turbo from when I got there. Mm-hmm. mostly because Chris was soaking wet and it was still wet and the road was slippery. You, Dion came down with you, I think, on the last rep and was just like, yeah, that road is getting sketchy. We didn't know enough about the road about that time. I'd only just got there. So it was like, just get him indoors, get him on the turbo, at least, even if it's only for a couple of hours, just to kind of reestablish like a benchmark, get some food in, warm him up and just kind of lock everything back in again.
Yeah. Yeah. And Andy and Jack sitting very patiently there. You guys kind of went into this from a sort of different perspective, because from your, I guess from your perspective, it's all about making sure you sort of get the shots you need, telling a story and producing incredible content like the video that's gone up on Chris's YouTube and all of the amazing photos and stuff. Going into a challenge like this, I guess, what did you think of the location? Was it kind of good for you? How do you adapt when the story that you've maybe created then completely changes? How do you, you know, how was that sort of initial experience for you, Andy?
The idea of I didn't really create a story in my head, to be honest. I just point a camera at someone and figure out what happens later. It's literally how it is, though.
It's kind of how it needs to be, though, right? I guess if you're very structured about it, then when things completely change, then you're screwed, right?
Exactly, yeah. The idea of changeable weather is my favourite thing, and actually every single thing me and Chris has done together, I always say, I really hope it fucking rains. The rain constantly, because actually, if you get Chris when he's really grumpy and point a camera in his face, he tries not to swear and tell you to piss off, basically. And that's the kind of best thing you want, because he's on like the edge of like cracking and you just want to capture that. It sounds really horrible to say, but that's what people want to see, isn't it? Because if Chris was, like we say, if we went to Tenerife and Chris was just going up and down 700 times doing that, then actually I don't think many people would watch it. It's like the things that go wrong, which is shit for you, Chris, but the thing is, it's great for me, because I sit there like, yes, I'm not going to stop filming. Sounds really horrible, but that's exactly what sponsors want to see as well, realistically, because that's what gets viewed. So
I don't think I've ever told you to fuck off, though.
You're very close at some points.
I've been very close at points, but I don't think I've ever told you, like, in a nasty way to fuck off in anything we've done. And there's definitely been points where it's been close, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I think going into this, it was kind of like the location was absolutely stunning. Like, it's difficult to find a part on that climb and an angle to shoot both video and photos that's not in some way aesthetically really good. When we had to come in onto the trainer, I think we had to kind of have a bit of a sit down and thinking like, okay, how can you make something like sitting on a turbo look cinematic and aesthetic? But at the same time, it's like we said, you know, this is documentary. This is, we're just there to document and capture the moments as they happen, and as long as we're capturing that accurately and showing the raw kind of what's happened, then it kind of speaks for itself, I guess. Like, technically speaking, when you sat at a table and you're just filming someone put a bandage on someone's hands, there's nothing technically beautiful about it in terms of filming it or photographing it, but it's the story behind it, and it's when you put that in context with everything else that's the main thing that we had to do, really, isn't it?
Totally. And I think that's what people connect with as well, isn't it? I think actually you're right, Andy. When things go perfectly and it's like, he's a winner and everything was fine and he's just a superhuman, like, no one actually connects with that. People connect with the sort of the struggle and things do go wrong, and it's how the human angle of how you adapt to that, I guess, isn't it?
I guess it's exactly what Jack said. It's about the story behind it. It's what you said in the first day. It's like, I've gone to so many challenges with Chris and just filmed everything of him riding, and it comes to the end of it, it goes to the edit, and it's, you only use 1% of it, and it's just a complete waste of time. I think with going and filming so much stuff with Chris in the last few years, you kind of realize that you don't need to film everything. You just know when something's going to happen at the same time. And like you said, Jack, it's just about the story behind it as well. It's about everyone. And that's why there were so many interviews throughout it and talking to so many people, because it's not just about Chris riding up and down the hill. It's everything around it instead.
I mean, in reality, if you do watch the film, there's actually very little of me riding. It's much, as you say, it's much more about the context of how other people are perceiving the situation and how it's being managed and dealt with by everyone here, and also from people who came along at various points. The reality of it is, there's not actually much cycling in it at all, which is I think is what makes it so strong, personally.
There is quite a bit of cycling.
It's quite a lot of cycling in it, Chris. I'm glad you're on the same wavelength, Jimmy.
And there's you riding a bike though, Jimmy, which is great. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, it's got a motor on it though. It doesn't really count.
It does count.
It counts. It's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, so you finished the end of day one on the turbo, having completed an Everest for the day. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
You went to sleep, you woke up day two, and the plan was still to either be inside or outside, but kind of try and do an Everest a day. What was the point where that changed? I can't remember now.
I actually think that at the end of day one, me, Andy and Jack had a secret emergency meeting, which was, this is definitely not happening. We need to keep Chris alive and just kind of keep moving, come up with some kind of plan. But this is 100% not going the distance. Mm. That is what happened at the end of day one.
Yeah, I remember.
Knowing that that happened, of course.
I must have been asleep or something.
Me and Jimmy were sharing a room, and like throughout the entire evening downstairs before everyone went to bed, we were kind of looking at each other a bit like, he looks pretty bad right now. And I was like, well, no, optimism, you know, it's fine. He'll get into a rhythm. And then we laid in beds next to each other. And then Jimmy was just like, I don't think he's going to do this, you know. We were like, we might have to think about this.
So yeah, then day two was a case of get Chris on the bike. It's a long day, so we've got a lot of time to like just see what happens, see if we need to adapt things, have a conversation with other people like you, like whoever we need to speak to, just to be like, how do we keep moving this on to achieve what Chris wants to achieve from it?
Totally. And I think there's a point there, isn't there? Because you could go, okay, well, it's the end of day one, the rules have changed, and we don't think that going through day two he's even going to reach what he wants to reach on day two, so why don't you stop it? But actually, I think the story and the reason that we continued is actually it's bigger than, I guess, just completing the seven Everests, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Chris, you can talk more about the reason that you did this challenge in the first place and the sort of connection between your struggle and sort of mental health struggle. But I guess, what are the reasons that you wanted to keep going with it?
So I had a very frank phone call, I think, with Ken on Tuesday morning as well. And I said to Ken, I remember saying to Ken, I think that's when I'd kind of accepted that I didn't think that this was achievable. And Ken's very pragmatic and very, you know, he's a coach, he's very numbers driven. And he was like, his response was, well, now you need to look at if it's worth rescheduling, if it's worth, you know, persisting with it, and just trying to make the most of the week. And I just turned around and said, I'm not rescheduling this. I do not want to have to then try and do this again, because at least I've got one day done. Like, I don't want to have to think about doing seven, and I'd rather think about the fact that there's six left. And he said to me, okay, well then you need to understand, you need to really call on that strength in your mind to why you're doing it, and that needs to be the driving factor to why you carry on. And the why factor for me was that ultimately this challenge was kind of, there was two, I guess, points of it. Part of it was fundraising for Movember. But the other part of it is really just to open up those discussions about mental health. And when I talk about mental health, I mean that in men and women. And I mean that in the context that I was having some very difficult discussions with people who I was riding with. And when I say difficult, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in the sense that they became weights on my shoulder during the challenge, and were hard, you know, hard to hear some of the stories. It's really hard. There's probably 10 different stories like that. And for me, there's something that really goes well with the idea of climbing and descending on a bike, to that relation to mental health, that there's always, you can spiral out of control quite badly and quite downwards quite easily. Descending's easier, And there's a lot of hard work and half graft to climb out of it, but you can climb out of a situation. And that to me was where there's a synergy between Everesting or previously with trenching and mental health. And I think then, you know, for me, the reason for Movember is they supported me personally through some pretty shit situations I've had involving friends and not just in the context of support for me personally, but support for a friendship group of people who had some not good things to deal with. And Movember don't directly necessarily offer counselling, but they offer the services to allow you to know how to reach out to different people. And they will tell you to contact people like Samaritans, for example, but they will provide, they provide a very incredible toolkit on how you should bridge one of those conversations with someone who maybe you haven't heard for a long time. And that, I am pretty adamant, had saved a friend's life at some point. And if I had known it sooner, I think it would have helped save another friend's life. So for me, there's a real importance to Movember and why and the work they do. And yes, they do all the stuff with testicular cancer, but the stuff they do with mental health is equally important. And I think that ended up becoming the driving factor of wanting to continue and try, literally to try my best every single day. Whether that meant getting an Everest, not getting an Everest, stopping for half a day, whatever it meant. We knew that we had so many different things up against us out of, you know, take away the fact that every day I was feeling shitter. The conditions really were the one thing that we couldn't control. You know, we could control having me on a turbo. We can control, you know, making sure I was, you know, the bike was clean, the food and all that was good. The kit was good. Everything was working fine. The one thing we couldn't control was the weather. And so I think in my mind, I was pretty determined to continue and just do the best I could and try and do justice to the reason of why I was trying to do it. And whether that was getting an Everest or not, that kind of eventually, I mean, Jimmy knows me well enough to know that that would have bugged me for quite a while, but it got to a point where I think I'd accepted that all I could do was the best I physically could every day. And I was going to try and do that. And yeah, it became quite detrimental at points, but that was how I had to get through it. And that's how it sort of became to me as a challenge. It was like, if I give this 110, 120%, I know that I've done all I physically can, and whatever the numbers are, that's fine.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it was the right decision as well, because as you say, there were far more reasons to keep going than there were to stop. And I think that, you know, even through doing our live coverage, you could see how many people were engaged and connected with it. And we also had people reach out to us in our direct messages and say, you know, share their stories of mental health struggles and the fact that how cycling had helped them, and seeing the sort of stuff that you're doing and the sort of friendship that clearly was there and the support was there was really sort of inspiring. So I think it became so much bigger than just that initial kind of seven Everest in 7 days thing. It became a sort of a talking point and a reason to open up about, you know, mental health struggles ultimately, wasn't it?
I think for me, what it was always like, you give a project like this a really big title, like saying seven Everest in 7 days, it hooks people in. And that's, you need to have some kind of hook with whatever the story is to get people involved in it. And then when people when people are kind of invested in it, whatever comes of it, they're then going to be invested in wanting to follow that story, because you get the attention, but it opens up the opportunity to increase those discussions that you need to once you've got people's attention.
I also said it at the time as well. I think I wrote it on the nightly post that we were doing, but I think there was also an element of like your well-being and your mental health in the sense that, like, every time we do these podcasts after these big challenges, I kind of say, like, you put yourself out there so publicly and saying, I am doing this massive thing.
Yeah.
And I think we both know that, like, in endurance challenges, you're probably more likely to fail than you are to succeed. Like, if you look at the entrants in any kind of endurance ride or race lineup, most people won't finish.
Yeah.
And yet every single time you're not in a group, you're on your own and you're saying, I'm going to do this massive thing to all of these people who are waiting and watching and expecting, knowing that there's a good chance you might fail in it. So I think that it was important for us, I guess, as sponsors, but also as your friends. And I'm sure, you know, Andy and Jack around you as well. Like, I think it's probably harder for you to say, can't do it, rather than them take the decision out of your hands and kind of say you shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
I think there was such a massive and like really quick difference from when we approached this in being like one Everest every day, and you'd hit the first one and it had struggled, and then you got to the second day, and even the morning you woke up you were so quiet, you were so like, I think the how daunting it was to think I have to do that again. And then again and again and again and again and again, or however many times. That is such an overwhelming and daunting prospect to think of. And it was just as soon as we took that out of the equation and we just said, well, let's just do what you can every day, and you have us there with you, and we're just going to keep you going. How much of a relief that seemed to have on you, and how much you seemed to just suddenly kind of like sit back and stick your chest out and just kind of crack on with it. It was like, okay, that kind of weight was lifted a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you know, I mean, I've always, the other thing to say is I've always said with any challenge, it's a we, it's not an I, and because they wouldn't happen without other people and that support. Like, can't do it. I wouldn't have done this without everyone that's here right now, and I'm very, very humbled by the fact that you guys and girl stuck it out with me still, you know.
Cool.
Well, we all nearly left at a point, to be honest. No, we didn't. I don't think we actually said, we haven't made clear. So the problem with day one was Chris got really, really wet, was sitting in wet hands and wet feet for hours, so all of his hands were all like horrible and soft and squidgy and crap. His body decided it didn't want to take on food, so you weren't absorbing food very well, which meant you didn't want to eat. So by the time you finished day one, you were like in a hole, in to the extent that a normal person would probably have just stayed in bed for 5 days. Yeah. But you knew you had to get up the next day and carry on doing it.
There was a lot of damage done on that first day.
Yeah, and I think that's like, you've done Everests and more than Everests before, and you've probably been relatively fine, fine the next day, but you probably could have jumped on your bike and been like, yeah, okay, that was tough, but you know, I'm all right. Mm. Whereas I think off the back of the day one on this, you were probably in the worst state you've been after doing the equivalent amount of effort.
But what we were saying that he looks the worst on the end of day one, and every single day from that, you actually looked a lot better.
So then day two was really about was about kind of getting you into a state that you would be able to sit on a bike for, what is it, 12 hours a day, 14 hours, whatever it was a day. So day two was literally like, in my head, I see it as like recovery day, which is bonkers to think that you did 7,500 meters or whatever it was on a day that's a recovery day. It's just bonkers.
Yeah.
And then it just ultimately became a damage limitation exercise for the subsequent days, which was like, we just need to keep it controlled, keep it clean, keep food going in, keep fluids going in, keep the salts going in, get him massaging, get him strapped up where he needs to be, control it, keep him out of the wet, keep him in fresh kit, keep him happy, keep him energized, keep him thinking about happy things and having a good time and it being an enjoyable thing, in the hope that if we did that long enough, you would start to get back into a place where you're like, oh, right, yeah, I'm back. Like, I'm back in a space. I'm Chris. I ride a bike, rather than being, I'm Chris, I want to be in bed.
Hmm. Yeah.
You think that happened?
Oh, yeah, it did.
In day three and moving on.
Well, it wasn't, I think it was maybe day four that, I mean, do you know what, it was four or five that was the difference. Day one was put Chris in a hole. Day two was like, hang on if we can. Day three was like, oh, this is going to take longer to recover than possible. Day four was like glimmer of hope. day five was like, oh wait there, we're back. This is it now. Chris is coming back to life. Mm-hmm. People were starting, more and more people were starting to show up and like get involved. And then from that point, it was like, right, we're back on track here. Chris is back. We're in the zone. We're back on track. Let's really drive this home now and make and finish this story. Make it a complete epic.
Mm. You say that, but I'll be honest. Like, I think past about day three, it all, that whole part there is a blur. I don't really know what day is what.
Well, no, I'm the same as you. Emily was
day five.
Sorry, go on, Jack.
Day five was the day where he actually did 9,500 meters. So day one was the Everest, and then day two was slightly less. Day three was slightly less. Day four was around about the same, and then day five just jumped up again, and then it was just Everest for the last 3 days again. So it was, yeah, there was definitely that turning point of after recovering of just being like, he's back.
I guess with hindsight, not that you ever would do it again, but if you did want to do it again, with this same crew, probably what you learned from the first couple of days and what it took to kind of get back on track, you'd potentially, if you got a good solid first couple of days in, you could probably maintain it a lot better, because it was kind of sort of chasing your tail too much to really recover.
100%, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So, I agree. I think if the, with this same crew, and if we had the right conditions, that it's completely doable.
Arguably, even with the same conditions, knowing what we know now,
yes,
you would have finished day one in a state that wasn't the state that you were. Because it would have been so much easier for us to go, oh, the weather is really bad, the road is sketchy, get him out of it.
Mm.
But obviously, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I think with the talking about, I know we've sort of dwelled on the weather and the road surface, and I think I was definitely, there was a few points, I don't really know what day it was, but one of the days where I definitely came down, and I think I said to you, Jimmy, my back was sliding all over the place. This is, something's not right here. And then we looked at the rear tire and we were like, oh fuck, that's very, 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 very bald. And I don't know what day that was, maybe day four. But that just showed the continual, they weren't brand new tires, I put that out there, but they were in good condition still. But the continual like torque you're having to put through the bike and how it just weared out that rear tire was pretty insane. But also, you know, before that hand, I could feel that the bike was just sliding around the corners regularly, which is not a nice feeling when you're riding up and down the same hill, because it just kind of like, it's one of those things that sits in your head as a little niggle every time you go around that corner. You're like, oh, this corner was one I slipped on. And you brake a little bit more and slow down a little bit more. And then it ends up that you're descending, instead of 4.5 minutes, it's 5.5 minutes. Very quickly that changes.
I think really the perfect, if you could pick the ideal road to do an Everest on, it wouldn't have any turns. Because exactly. Like, if you think a technical descent involves a hairpin when you're like lucid, doing that after like, you know, 70 Six hours days. Of ride or whatever it is, yeah, it just like, it becomes harder and harder and harder and slower, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely.
And more dangerous.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You talked about the importance of like getting that sort of nutrition side back on track. I don't know what day it is, but obviously there was a big bump in the road with that when your box of food mysteriously disappeared.
I've got a theory, actually. I actually think, based on what Andy said earlier,
Andrew Storley,
I think he's involved, because they literally went up to the climb just before it went missing to replenish it, and then later I get a phone call. It was you, wasn't it?
Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. Just for the cinematography, that's why I did it.
So if we go back a little bit, can you explain what actually happened when you realised how that kind of whole thing went down? Go on, Jimmy.
Me? Oh, okay. I don't know. Get them to explain it, because they were actually there.
Okay. Was there.
Okay. Well, actually, I can't remember any of the week anymore. I've blurred it all out of my memory.
Forget about the days from now on. It's just events that happened.
What the hell happened? Where...
I went what down the climb because I...
We were going to go buy more food, weren't we, Jack?
Yeah, so...
Yeah, we
so
were on the way Chris, to buy more food and we were like... Chris was... Yeah, I can't remember.
And then I think Jimmy was snoozing.
Oh, I was...
he was back at the house. He was back at the house and we were like, Jimmy was like, oh, you guys, can you go and drop off the box like with replenished bottles in and bars and gels and all that kind of stuff? And we were like, yeah. So we drove from the Airbnb around the corner up to the bottom of the climb, dropped the box off at the bottom of the climb, which is where we've been putting it, so that when Chris could come down before he went back up again, he could just replenish and then carry on. And we literally put the box down, got in the car, drove 5 minutes down the road to Co-op, started shopping in Co-op, and then that's when we got the message from Chris.
Because I'd been repping, and I'd drunk my bottles, and I was kind of out of food, and I was repping with a guy, I can't remember his name now off the top of my head, unfortunately, but he was a guy that was in the army, and we were going up and down, and I was like, oh, you know, there's stuff down there, I'll just go and get some more water, get some more food. And we came to the bottom, and he was like, the other chap was like, where's your stuff gone? And I was like, oh, they must have taken it away to put more stuff in it or something. So I then messaged going in the WhatsApp group going, guys, do you know what's happened to the box? And I think Jimmy was the first to reply going, well, it should be there, shouldn't it? And I was like, but no, it's not. And then that's when I think it was a, oh, fuck, from everyone. And the guy who I was with was like, oh, I've got some bars in the back of my car, which you can have. And, I can get some stuff. And then it just became this opportunity where we all just went, shit, what the fuck are we going to do? Because it wasn't just the fact that there's hundreds of pounds of bars and gels and stuff there. The big thing was the water bottles, more than anything, I would say, because we then had, I think we only had two water bottles, which was what was on the bike. That was it.
In hindsight, from what I've learned from this, is it was a bad idea to put literally every single piece of your on-bike food and bottles in one place in the middle of nowhere with no one else anywhere near it.
And no sign on it or anything.
I just assumed it would be fine.
Very trustworthy, Jimmy.
Yeah. I've been living in the north too long. People don't steal up here.
But the thing is, it wasn't stolen, was it? It wasn't some horrible person who had just stolen all of the stuff. Because I remember I was up in the northeast doing the kind of the social from home, seeing all of this group message of, where's the box? Oh my God, da, 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 where's the box? And I was like, what is the box? and obviously it transpired, it had gone missing. And I was like, oh, well, did you not have a note on it? And it was like, no, someone's stolen it, da, 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 da. And I think from there, the first thing that you asked was, can you get on our Instagram and put out a message for more bottles? Because that was the thing, wasn't it? It was bottles, like, you guys can go and get food, but we need bottles that'll fit on your bike so that we can, you know, you can continue doing your swap thing.
Yeah.
So we put a message out and loads of people got in touch. Like, it was really awesome. It was like so many people behind you and being like, oh, I'm, you know, half an hour away, but I'll get out of work and I'll come and get you some. And people turned up, didn't they, with yeah, water bottles. And then in between all of these messages that we were getting, I saw one in our comments that said, I've got your box. I said, what? It was
delivered. Held at ransom.
Bring Jimmy to the old mill at 5 o'clock. No one else must come. No, it was like, I've got your box. It's at the food bank. Where should I put it? And I was like, what? What does that even mean? And then, yeah, this woman messaged and it turned out she was from the food bank and some very kind, but not quite. I don't know what the word okay. is. Not quite. Ultimately, they had the best intentions, but they had mistakenly.
Someone had obviously thought that some stupid cyclist had left a crate of stuff at the bottom of their climb and decided to dispose of it for us in the best possible way. They didn't even put it in the bin or steal it. They were like, well, I'm going to donate it to charity. Which is actually amazing of someone to do.
Yeah. So the food bank people turn up and they were like, what are we going to do with all of these energy gels? and then she arranged to bring it back, didn't she? But that only happened because some of the people that actually brought you the bottles, Chris, they shared it on Facebook with like a local town group, and then they saw it through that. So it was a cool sort of little power of the internet thing. And then you got them all back at the end, which was like,
I did feel quite bad for us basically taking food from a food bank for Chris to ride up and down a climb.
Yeah.
But we donated to them instead, didn't we?
We did, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it as well. Like that, for me, of everything that happened during the whole thing, was probably the highest stress point of the whole challenge for me. Because
see, that's why you say that, because you were the most chill.
Yeah, we were running around. Me and Jack weren't shouting at the people in the cafe. We were quite kind, but we ran in there like bulls. Like, where's that food box?
I was driving around the local area for half an hour, like eyeing everyone up to see if I could find the crate somewhere.
A little group of youths on the side. You were like, I see you.
I considered going over, and then when we got to the bottom of the climb, Chris comes down. He's just like, oh, don't worry about it. This will be because we like made a couple of bits of jam sandwiches. You're like, oh yeah, this will be fine. I'm like, oh right, okay, it's not a big deal then, fine, whatever.
In reality, I was in the back of my mind, it was just like fire. There was little me sitting in a room. The house is on fire right now. It's all great, everything's good. That's what was going on in my head. But I thought in that situation, this is where I should try and be very calm.
Well, you definitely appeared it.
Oh, good, because I was not inside.
That story also made it onto Road CC as well. Like, cyclist completing Seven Everest has his food stolen. And there was all these comments like, those bastards! Like, really angry people. And the same on ours as well. It's like, those dickheads, what's wrong with the world? And then obviously it turns out
some little woman with a food bag with a little box of food.
Yeah.
It was quite funny on social media afterwards, seeing everyone that had gotten so angry and obviously so invested in it, being like, oh, how dare they, and all this. And then like 12 hours later, posting on their Instagram stories going, oh, actually, it was very nice of them to do this. Like, oh, tail between the legs, feeling bad for being so angry.
But it does also show then how many people were invested in what we were doing. And it was incredible that there was a lot of outside interest who wanted to help. It was really incredible.
It did, yes. And I mean, it was a good thing to talk about as well. I thought it was funny watching from afar, so.
It's great for Andy's story.
Yeah. Exactly what I needed.
Notice Andy's now going to seek rehab at the back of his mind and any other video stuff we do. Make sure something goes missing.
Something always happens. Oh, for God's sake. Something always happens whenever we do something like that. What was it, the coast to coast one we did?
Oh yeah, where I got pushed off the bike.
Yeah, I thought there was one that happened.
It was your mates, wasn't it, Andy, that did that?
150 quid down because of that.
I'm trying to think on 107 what happened.
I don't think anything really happened on 107.
Well, I did have like a fucked tire for about 3 days.
That's very true.
I could get to a bike shop and it was shredded. That was probably the worst of what happened.
I can't really think. I mean, I think the worst day was you riding back from John O'Groats back to that place, wherever it was, in a headwind for like 12 hours. Me and James are like, this is brilliant. Keep going.
Oh, and it wasn't just a headwind though. It was a stormy morning, wasn't it? Mm. Yeah. Not fun. Anyway.
But yes, it is these things that kind of add colour and bring people into sort of the challenge like this, isn't it? So I feel like it was either day three or day four. And then I feel like from there, it was the main sort of themes of the day were just kind of like hanging on for dear life, really.
I think it was after that day that more of our friends and people that we know and people that know Chris happened to be showing up. Because we had quite a few people, like some of our mates, you know, that were around, and ultimately we could tell that when Chris was with people, he was riding better than any other time. Mm. So there's essentially like on the road on his own, on the road with people, on the turbo on his own, on the turbo with people. And every time that there's people there, regardless of the other bits around it, he was riding stronger, he was riding faster, but not, I guess it's the perception of how it feels. He was just riding better.
Did you feel that, Chris? Did you notice a difference when there were people there?
Massively so. It's a distraction. That is as simple as that. It's a distraction, having a conversation with someone. Or, even I think in the case of when, both, like Louise and Josh were riding with me, for example, it wasn't necessarily that there was a lot of conversation, but it was a lot. It was quite often that it just having the company and knowing there was company. And then like Louise from Internationals, for example, she, especially on the, when she turned up, so she did a big stint with me outside and then jumped on the turbo with me. And in reality, we didn't actually say a lot to each other on the turbo, but she kept saying little things which just kept me chugging along. And that made a huge difference. In contrast, in a big contrast, I think it was day six, the Saturday, when there was a big group of people. And as incredible as it was, fuck me, I found that overwhelming. and I know why it was. It's because I was tired and worn out, and just, it was incredible that so many people wanted to come and support. But I remember saying to Francis, because Francis and Daisy had driven down the night before, and Francis was like, I'll come ride with you in the morning and everything like that. But, you know, Francis being Francis. And he looked at me when we saw this group of people, because we rode up. It was myself, Francis, Daisy, and I think a couple of us left from the Airbnb together on the bike. And Francis looked at me as he could see this group of people waiting by the gate. And I think Francis knows me well enough to know when I'm not comfortable. And he looked at me and just went, don't worry, mate, I'll ride next to you the whole time, so you don't have to deal with anything. And he did. And he sat next to me the whole time and just distracted me with funny stories about random shit. And yeah, it was incredible. I think in a normal context, I maybe wouldn't have found it so overwhelming, but it really, really like rocked me, which I was quite surprised at. And I think Jimmy, you saw that quite clearly and sort of were like, right, we're limiting this time.
I guess what some people, because I guess what some people might not understand is how you are in that particular moment. And that is like massively fatigued, in some respects, having to concentrate more than ever just to be able to like keep things upright. And then when you have lots of people around you, you're then all of a sudden thinking about, is that person too close? Is that wheel too close? Am I going to clip that wheel? Is this person realize that I'm slowing down? Do they know which line I'm taking? You're having to think about so much more that arguably you're not really capable of doing.
Yeah.
So what you end up doing is just not wanting all of those people there, so that you go, well, that's just something I can forget about because I'm already struggling just to ride this on my own.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, it's just completely true. And like it was it was incredible. So many people wanted to come and support, but I don't think I realized how much it would like rock my head quite a bit. Really took me off guard. Really did. Really like, but having equally on that particular morning, having Francis there, for example, because he knows me incredibly well, as we all know, and he kind of bossed around a bit on people and being like, fuck off, you know, being the person sort of telling people around to kind of get out of the way.
Just for the record, he didn't actually tell anyone to fuck off. What Chris means is he was assertive in making sure Chris had ample space around him.
You worded it better than me. He did not tell anyone to fuck off.
It is ultimately a case of, Francis making sure there's enough space around you so that you don't have to worry about, am I too close to that person on the side, or feeling like you're being driven to like the edge of the road or something or other. And in your state, you're thinking like you would need more space than you normally would because you might be a bit wibbly wobbly on the road or whatever.
Well, it's little things about like, I don't want to ride on the inside of a hairpin because it's a lot steeper. I want to ride on the outside of the hairpin. And Francis would have sat there and forced his way over to get me on the outside of the hairpin and things like that, which is just, experience and knowing someone to know how to deal with that situation. And he was fantastic. Yeah, he did great. He was fantastic to have him there, definitely.
And one of the people who did turn up that you mentioned earlier and who we saw in Andy's video was Dion, who, yeah. I mean, even just like seeing some of his story on the video is just absolutely heartbreaking. He lost his son to suicide, didn't he? And yeah. he joined you for, was it a couple of days?
I think we saw him every day.
Right, did you?
Whether that was on the bike or coming over to the Airbnb to just hang out and chat with us, I think we saw him every day. Mm. And Dion also managed to get us the key to the gate at the bottom of the climb so we could get a car up there. Dion, like, a lot of love and respect for that guy. He's an incredible human, and what he's doing with Josh's Lighthouse project is phenomenal. And yeah, incredible guy, really incredible guy. I think all of us were very, very touched by him and like moved by his story as well. He's had it hard, and he's doing amazing in the situation that he's doing, and what he's doing is, yeah, it's the reason what he's doing with Josh's Lighthouse project is phenomenal. And what I think I quite quickly realized, having spent quite a lot of time with him, is I was yes, there's an element of me doing this for Josh, his son, but there was probably even more of an element of me wanting to do this challenge for Dion and his other kids and his wife, because they're the people that were still there and still struggling. And he's very open about the fact that, you know, it is still a real struggle for him. He made everything very real, I think, for all of us. He really did.
Absolutely. And for people who don't know, Josh's Lighthouse Project is the charity that Dion set up, isn't it? And what do they do?
So Josh's Lighthouse Project is a charity that Dion set up with his wife in memory of his son, Josh, who took his own life in 2016. And the charity is focused about supporting young adults who are having very tricky situations themselves. So Josh took his own life after being quite severely bullied. And the charity is there as a support and kind of counselling opportunity for young people to help them to have those kind of conversations when they're having some tricky times as well. And he's, you know, very, very, very driven to be there for people in the area, which is incredible. It's really special. So if people listen to this, check them out.
They're using the funds that they raise to fund qualified counsellors to spend time with people that are not able or perhaps don't have the support to be able to get assistance from other places. So they're essentially funding counselling for people.
I thought it was really interesting as well how Dion was saying that where they live in that little isolated area of Wales, that part of the reason why he set up that charity as well is to help the people that don't have access to this kind of thing. And by you choosing that location, in hindsight, was the best thing you could have done for that community of people, because it put them on the map and it put that awareness out there, and it actually helped grow that awareness and hopefully that confidence in where they are, that people can talk and that they do have something there to help and kind of spread that message again. So
definitely
just a pretty road.
That is actually a really interesting point, how many people that were local that were like commenting on about like how amazing it was that we were doing it there, because they were like, finally someone's doing something to like highlight our area.
Yeah.
So not even talking about the charity side of stuff, just actually just like local people which are like, oh, this is amazing, people are actually seeing how beautiful this part of the world is. And they want that, they want people to be there. It's amazing.
I mean, even on the back foot of the challenge, the amount of messages and tags in people's stories I've had of people who have gone and ridden the climb, like, and we're 3 weeks out from the challenge. And I think Jimmy and Emily, we first went there in 2018. Yeah. And it was, I mean, even then we were just amazed by it. It's such a beautiful stretch of road and a beautiful part of the world. Like, it's incredible around there, really incredible. And Andy's got plenty of experience of curry shops around there.
I had what I thought was the best curry of my entire life there about 6 years ago. I went to Red Bull Hardline, the mountain bike festival just around the corner. It's literally in that town.
Yeah.
And I remember after a very long day and after quite a few beers, I went to a curry shop and I raved about it every single time I went to a curry shop. Oh, the best curry places in Blaenau-Ffestiniog in North Wales. I went back there. I don't know how you would rate it, Chris.
It's still pretty good.
I give it a solid 6.
I would have gone 7. I would have gone 7.
I think that's when it was such high expectations.
Well, you hyped it up for yourself. But take that away. Like, as you know, there's been a series of, you know, you talk about Red Bull Hardline's been in the area. There's been things going on in that area, but it just doesn't. There, it's such an incredible place to ride and explore that I think part of me really does hope that having done this challenge, we can somehow help highlight that as well, because it is a beautiful part of the world. It really is.
It is gorgeous. And there's a lot to be said for the importance and the benefits of not only being outside, but like the power of nature and what that can do for your mental health as well. I think, like,
completely.
If you're not riding, like walking is amazing around there. And just like the scenery is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing definitely. History behind that place, as we found walking down it, didn't we, Jimmy and Jack?
Yeah. Lots of history. That was kind of how we filled our day, wasn't it? It was like, what's over there? Let's Google it.
I'm like the hour it took us to get to the top when we were walking.
Yeah.
We were just looking at things and Googling bits. And like, Andy had just come out of nowhere and be like, oh, 1920, this was so blah, 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 blah.
And one other thing, Chris, just going back to like the mental health aspect, as well as obviously raising money for Movember, which was like incredible. I don't know what your charity page is at now, but it was, I feel like it was 11 grand or something by the end, wasn't it?
Just short of 14 now.
That's amazing. Should be very proud of that. Well done.
Very proud of that. I think everyone should be proud of that.
Yeah, absolutely. But I, again, we raised it on our stories at the end, but I think one of the other powerful things, and it's definitely part of your character, and when you do these kinds of challenges, is like, you're definitely not afraid to like show vulnerability. And I think especially with Movember, and the reason that they focus on men's mental health specifically, is that really as a society, we don't really like to see weakness in men. Men are afraid to show weakness and crying and, you know, like hugging, all of that kind of thing. And it all contributes to negative mental health specifically for men. And I think it's really interesting that not only are you showing that kind of struggle, but like, ultimately you're crying and you're quite happy for that to be caught on film and to kind of be open about it. And I think that's also a really powerful message to send, even that, you know, you don't even have to like say it, but showing it I think is really powerful as well.
I think showing your emotion is a strength, it's not a weakness, and I don't think it should ever be seen as a weakness. I think the fact that I am quite an emotional person probably allows me to push myself harder on a lot of these kind of challenges. It really does. And I think, as you say, for men, it's maybe has been perceived in the past to be a sign of weakness. And like some of the conversations I had, with certain people were saying that that's unfortunately something they've seen with people they've lost, is that people wouldn't show their emotion. So they never really truly realize how much someone's struggling. But I think that collectively, you know, I have no issues with a camera being shoved in my face with me flooding, with my eyes flooding full of tears. Like, to me, that was as important. That was probably even more important than doing the Everests or any of it, was being able to show that vulnerability. And I think, as you wrote on Ask Us, is showing that vulnerability is actually a real strength for people to have. And being able to, you know, have that support network around you to allow you to do whatever you want to do is incredibly powerful. Like I've always said, this is a we. It's not an I, it's a we. This wouldn't happen without everyone that's in this podcast, or without, you know, messages from certain people, or without, you know, my partner, my freaking Muppet of a dog, my coach, whoever it is, that, you know, Francis and Daisy coming down, Lou, you know, whoever it is, it wouldn't happen without those people. That you need that support network, and that's so important. for challenges like this, and also so important for people who are having struggles. So there's, you know, if anything, I think as I've reiterated it many times, if there's anything anyone can do, is just, if there's someone that you haven't heard from, send a message or call them up and just chat. Like, it can go a long way and change someone's day.
Absolutely. So I can't remember what day we're on now, but I think kind of the, I think for all of us really, and the end was sort of a blur, but by those end, by that end of that challenge, like, how, what sort of state were you in, and what was the recovery like after it?
I think with the end of the challenge, so what we did was, there's a large proportion of that last day was done indoors because the conditions were obviously, as a theme of this has gone, weren't great. Andy had a massive confetti cannon, which genuinely scared the shit out of me. And
I wanted to do it on the first day, but
we only had one. Could have done it every day if you bought seven. Oh, next time. Anyway, so I...
Oh, no. There is no next time.
It was, I think, the last day, I was very, very determined to get to an Everest because it was the last day. And we'd sort of discussed that it was, you know, there was going to be a large portion of it done indoors. And that moment when Andy, I was counting down, and there's the videos on Instagram, and Andy actually spliced one together, which is from my phone, everyone's phones, which is on my Instagram account. And it's, you see it from many different perspectives. And for me, that moment, I basically felt like Jimmy was about to push me off the bike. And then Andy was going to push me off the bike. And I carried on pedaling because I didn't realize I had to stop. And then Jimmy was standing there shouting at me, going, stop pedaling. And I remember just looking, to me, I was looking at Jimmy like, what do you mean stop pedaling? We will fucking pedal. And then eventually stopped. But then it didn't actually end there. That's the thing. Like, to me, that wasn't the finish. The finish was, I was going up that climb and riding the last hairpins. That was the end, even though that was over in Everest. So what, we technically rode the Everest indoors because it was like, cool, that's done. We can tick that, that's done. And then we decided to finish on the climb, which to me felt right. And I think to all of us kind of felt right to do that as the four of us together finishing on the climb. I didn't ride the full thing. We drove up to the hairpins. And then I got out. You guys drove to the top. And I got to ride the last hairpins on my, which is basically all I wanted to do that day, was to ride the last bits on my own and see you guys at the top. And that was how we ended it. And then I struggled to get off the bike. I nearly fell off the bike. And I remember Andy with a camera, Jack with a, Andy with a camera, Jack with a camera, and Jimmy was basically going, come here to me. Struggled to get off the bike, gave Jimmy the bike, and then we walked to the cars, which are parked slightly on the hill with the headlights on. And I think you and I, we had a hug. I had a lot of tears. And then we walked to the cars. And I remember going, Jimmy, I should have just rode up to the fucking cars. And that was basically, and then we were talking about Toy Story, weren't we?
Were we?
We were talking about, you said, this is like the end of some epic film where you just like walk off into the sunset. And I went, it's a bit like Toy Story, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we were then trying to work out what characters we were. And I think you said you'd be Slinky.
I think you'd be Mr. Potato Head, actually.
Don't make me Mrs. Potato Head.
But anyway, that last, to me, that finishing on the climb, we did the Everest indoors so that it was done and I could enjoy that last little bit and finish at the top with my mates who'd been there the whole time. That was perfect.
It just felt right, didn't it?
It really did.
We didn't need to do it.
No, we didn't need to do it.
But I don't know, for some, we just all wanted to go up there, and it was, I'm actually glad that you weren't doing those kind of because it was so dark up there, and it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. It was one of those ones where you just kind of like, I don't want to go too far from the car because something's going to like come out of the sky and pick me up and take me away. but it just felt right going up there to do it.
It really did, didn't it? Mm. And I think, it was like a good closure to that challenge. And then subsequently we then went back, drove back down. I can't even remember. We ate a load of food. I don't know what it was. I think I actually had a beer. I don't think I drank it all, but
I think you had about three sips of a beer.
That's three sips more than I normally have. So yeah. And then we had a Colin the Caterpillar or something, didn't we? That Daisy and Francis bought.
Yeah, Daisy brought a cake.
Yeah, and we all just sort of sat and had a little laugh and a chat, and then I think all of us were fucking knackered and went to sleep.
Mm. Fair enough. You finished, I haven't got the exact figures, but it was something like 56,000 odd metres of climbing, wasn't it, for the week?
Yeah.
96,000 on the bike.
Well, there's some interesting bits that have come out of this since chatting with Ken. So Ken has basically turned around and told me that we broke Training Peaks. So Training Peaks is a program which records rides and data. It's very coaching specific, but it clearly does not like doing things like this. And it's the third time I've broken Training Peaks. So I think that's quite an accolade. And the reason why I mention this is basically Training Peaks thinks it might, has basically given three different answers to the time, how many hours it was. And it's from anything from 92 hours to 103 hours. Not sure why or how, but there's a discrepancy there. Strava, I think, says up 92, basically. And then the other discrepancy on Training Peaks is the amount of calories burned, which was saying anything from 48,000 to 65,000. That's a lot of calories. And then it freaked out with all the elevation and hours, like it just broke it. So Ken was like, congratulations, mate, you've broken Training Peaks again. That's a third one for you. Well done. But I think if you adding up the numbers, it worked out at about 6.5 Everests in total over the course of the week. And say 90 to 100 hours of riding, which is more than some people do in a month.
It's more than a lot of people do in a year.
Well, not done that for 3 years, right?
You're in a bubble, Chris. This is how the rest of us live.
Okay, yeah, it's a lot of riding.
People do it a week, 100 hours.
A month.
Even in a month, it's not. No.
100 hour month is a big month for a pro rider, basically.
Normal people aren't pro riders.
Okay, for normal people, it's
probably... Because you're just walking around life thinking everyone's a pro cyclist.
You're a pro cyclist. Jimmy's a pro cyclist. Jack's a pro cyclist. Emily's a pro cyclist. Bella's a pro cyclist. You know, everyone is. I think the next day, Andy left incredibly early.
Jack, did I tell you this? I found your keys in my car. I've driven an hour. I was going...
I had no idea.
Yeah, I was going south instead of just going along because apparently it was quicker because there was loads of road closures. I drove an hour in the pissing rain. I had no petrol as well, and there were no petrol stations. And I was like, oh, I wonder where the petrol station is. I turned around to grab my phone, and your keys were there. And I was like,
oh. No, I didn't know that.
I stopped. Do you know when you have that moment, you sit there and you're like...
Well, there's something that happened that I don't think you know, Andy, was that Jack's car also refused to start.
Oh, yeah, that happened, yeah. I had a flat battery.
We had a flat battery and a flat tyre. And so we called up my dad, who is a weird oracle of everything cars. He used to be a mechanic for a very long time. And he basically told us this very weird routine to get your car to restart, didn't he? It was like, rock the car. Put the key in, take the ignition out, lock the car, unlock the car, and it will start. And we were like, nah. And we did, and it just went, whoa. And my dad's on the phone going, told you so.
Pumped your tire up with a track pump, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, track pumps are great.
I didn't think it would work, but it worked.
It worked really well.
The biggest revelation, is that the word? Revelation of the Monday morning was when we started tidying up, and all of a sudden I could hear the bowl and spoon chattering through the wall. And I was just like, oh, that's really loud. And then realized that the people which owned the eco guest house we were staying in were like on the other side of the thinnest wall possible for an entire week of us, like pumping horrible music, jumping around, shouting. The language was atrocious.
Yeah.
I only imagine how horrible their week was, but
they must have been fuming when we were paying the quarter at 11:30.
But they didn't even even on the Monday when we then saw them, they were so supportive and amazing and happy. And I was like, oh, I've realized you actually could hear us. They were like, yeah. I was like, sorry about that. They're like, oh, don't worry about it. We're like, these guys are amazing.
They were incredible. That the place we stayed at were fantastic. If anyone wants a place to stay, check them out. I can't remember.
What's it called?
Eco guest house, isn't it?
Eco guest house at the bottom of Stoolandam. Search for that, it will come up. John and Celia are their names. They're like, massive shout out to them. Also, massive shout out to the fact that John baked me a loaf of bread.
Oh, he did. Yeah, it was great.
Didn't he? And it was amazing because whatever the bread was that we'd got from Co-op was so thinly sliced. And it really, tiny things bug you on these kind of things. And it really pissed me off was that this bread was the thinnest sliced bread I've ever seen in my life. So no sandwich was a sandwich as far as I was concerned. It was a wafer.
It was
wafer thin. Yeah. But yeah, they were incredible.
That's one of those weird little in-jokes that everyone's going to be like, why are they saying wafer thin? What happens after 100 hours of watching someone cycle a bike?
Yeah, it was the massive shout out to John and Celia because they were incredible. They were always around, they were always positive, and if we needed anything, they were a phone call away. And the place they've got is carbon negative. That's correct, isn't it? So it's a really incredible and fascinating Airbnb rental holiday home that you have there. So yeah, amazing stuff. Really cool.
So, I have a question. The dog's just walking up and she needs a bit of attention. I have a question, quick fire for everyone. In hindsight, what one thing would you have done differently? Jimmy, go.
Being there from the beginning.
Okay, Chris.
Doing it.
What thing would you do different doing it so you wouldn't do it?
I wouldn't do it in the UK.
Fair. Jack?
What would I have done different?
What would you think would have gone better had something gone different, if you don't have a specific about you?
I think if we'd have gone into this knowing Jimmy wasn't going to be there, what we had to do to keep Chris alive.
That is fair. Andy?
Packed more waterproof trousers.
I do want to add as well that Andy and Jack didn't do anything wrong.
Didn't do anything.
But there is that. But you wouldn't necessarily know you have to do anything. It's one of the unique things of me having been involved in so many of these kind of things, specifically with Chris as well, that I know what needs to happen. It's not that you did anything wrong. It's that, you know, you just haven't been in that scenario before.
I guess what it is that no one was prepared.
It wasn't anyone's job.
Exactly. It wasn't anyone's job. It should have been someone's job and a role from the start, I guess, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
And the thing is, the other thing to mention is Jimmy has been there throughout challenges for since 2016, maybe even before then, in fact, but at least 2016, which is when the first 107 was. So Jimmy has, I will always say it, and I even did a gushing, loving post to you, Jimmy, on social media.
You did. It was lovely. Thank you.
Because I was feeling really emotional that day and I wanted to express some love to you. Jimmy knows me better than anyone else, especially in that context. And that's why, to me, the moment Jimmy turned up, I was like, whatever happens now is fine. It doesn't matter now because there's someone there that's got my back, whatever happens. And it's not that Jack or Andy didn't, you know, you guys were incredible. I can't fault you guys at all, but there's an element of Jimmy has had that knowledge and experience for years. And there's no one else that has that. And there's no one else who could have that.
And like, you know, like Andy's there to make a film. Yeah. Jack's there to take photos.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be like, oh, am I supposed to take Chris's shoes off at this point? Like, why would you think to do that?
Let me take a photo at that point or film that bit. Exactly.
Don't take Chris's shoe. I need that photo.
Yeah. No. And I think everyone, I feel that everyone had my best interests at heart, which was to keep me going, to keep me safe, and to keep positive around me. And I really appreciate that.
I've just remembered
when he stole your food.
Yeah.
Remembered there was actually one point in the week where all three of us, me, Jack, and Andy, were like, is this actually really bad? And it was when Chris came down from a power nap. So we were using power naps in the last few days just to keep him functioning, essentially. And he came down from one of his naps and was just like, I just had a nosebleed. And all of it, we didn't say anything because we were like, we need to absorb this information before we react because we don't want to like stress Chris. And then Chris gets back on his bike and we're just kind of like, I'm all of a sudden very aware there isn't a medical professional here. Do we need to do something more with this piece of information? And yeah, we didn't, and Chris didn't die, so it's brilliant.
I literally,
Jimmy did with that information was go, get back on the bike.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, because I think I Jimmy was shouting at me to hurry up because I was upstairs after a power nap, and the reason why I was taking longer was because I was cleaning up this sink of blood, basically, because I woke up, went to the toilet, and just blood was pouring down my face, and I could hear Jimmy go, come on Chris, you're supposed to be on the bike now, come on, like at the top of your voice shouting it. And I'm thinking, oh fuck, I mean fuck, because I'm half asleep still and having a panic and I'm already fucked, and I'm like, fuck, I'm gonna fucking get the toilet roll, clean the blood up, wash it away, put it somewhere.
Did a great job of cleaning it up because there was no blood.
Maybe there wasn't actually ever any blood. It was just him.
He was just creating story for you, Andy.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. And then, I mean, if we think of like after effects of the whole thing, I still can't feel this finger.
Which is that the little one or the ring finger?
The ring finger. I can't feel it. It's like tingly and weird. And my small toe on my left foot. Might as well chop it off. Can't feel it.
Maybe it has been chopped off.
Wait.
We checked.
It's still there. Still there. It's okay. I can see it. So it must mean it's there. Yeah, it's not a hallucination. And then, you know, for me, I went on holiday, basically. I went on holiday for a week because I really needed to decompress. And people don't ever talk about the aftermath and how these kind of things affect you. And that, to be honest, is probably harder to deal with than any other part of the challenge, because there's an element of it's done, which is incredible. You feel very proud of yourself. But then the next thing that happens is that whole, fuck, I still feel like shit. I feel physically exhausted. I feel the thing with this challenge, I found more than any other challenge, is how much mentally fucked I was and still am. I'm still struggling with that, like emotionally a bit all over the place. But that is going back to this thing where being able to talk to people about that is so important, and understanding that is really is part of the parcel of, you know, effectively torturing your body for a week.
And I think on that note, there needs to be a don't try this at home statement made that this isn't something that people should just be doing. You're someone which is trained very extensively for a long period of time with a lot of build up to an event, like literally 5 or 6 years of build up to an event this significant, with people around you which do know what they're doing. Jokes aside, both myself and Jack are first aid trained at least, and we knew where all of the local medical professionals actually were if we needed them.
Yeah.
And it isn't something that people should just be like, yeah, let's have a crack at this, because it's very significant. It can be dangerous, which is why it was so closely monitored and kept as safe as it possibly could be. And we wouldn't have hesitated to stop the event if there was any point that we thought it was actually unsafe for Chris to continue doing it.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a point, wasn't there, where we were driving down after doing a run, you were coming back up towards us,
yeah,
you pulled us over, and we're like, I need a caffeine gel. I was like, why? Why do you need it? You're like, oh, I'm falling asleep. I'm like, well, don't keep riding. Let's get you back to the house and have a break. You're like, oh, okay, I'll do that. And I'm like, we'll get back to the house, have a break.
Like that was the first time we did the power naps.
Oh, is that what that was when it's the power naps start? Well, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in those situations, sometimes you're so deep into it or you're so delirious, you make bad decisions. You kind of need an external source to make those decisions for you, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. To me, my mind was very logical that the solution was to have a caffeine gel, but I hadn't thought external of that, which was, oh, I could just go down to the Airbnb and go to sleep.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. And that's being tired and fatigued and being very linear focused.
I think, and despite all of the things that you could have done better and the things that went wrong, I think ultimately there are so many successes that came out of this. You know, the money raised for Movember, the fact that you did a phenomenal amount of climbing and time on the bike, the conversations that were had off the back of it, the photography is incredible, the video is so good, and that helps it go out further. I mean, it's really, really good. And so I think, like, ultimately it was only success that came from it, really. I think that's probably a good place to end, but does anyone have any final thoughts that they want to share?
Chris, when are you announcing the next challenge? Nine Everests in 6 days.
Yeah, I was purposely not asking that.
I know Andy's asking that as a joke. Fuck you. nothing out from my side, really. I don't know about anyone else.
Well, the obvious question is, what's next, Chris? What's next for you?
Jimmy, fuck you. No, what's next? I'm going to have a pizza tonight. I'm going to take my dog for a walk, and then I'm going to sleep. That's what's next.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, unless anyone else has anything to add, thank you all of you for coming and chatting it again. I hugely appreciate all of you as legends, and I genuinely don't think that this would have been a success as it was without all of you. So thank you, and thank you for being in this podcast. I love you all.
Thank you very much.
Well done.
Nice.